Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and joining me today is Professor Tim Parkin, who holds the Elizabeth and James Tertullus Chair of Classics at the University of Melbourne. This is episode CIII, Old Age in the Roman World. Classical authors such as Cicero and Plutarch would have us believe that the elderly were revered, active citizens of ancient Rome. But on closer inspection, that may not be the case, and older people mightn't have the power and respect in the Roman society that we first supposed. Here's Tim Parkin. There's a common perception that old age in the Roman Empire is maybe, you know, generally speaking, 40-ish is a good old age to live for, not just in the Roman Empire, but I suppose in antiquity and when you go back further in time, that people died earlier.
It's a very common misconception. People assume that we live longer today than we've ever lived in the past. And that's certainly true. More of us live into what we call old age. But it certainly happened in antiquity that some people lived well into their 60s, 70s or beyond. It's just that so many people would have died very young, in infancy or in the early childhood. If you survive infancy and early childhood, chances are you're going to go on to live into your 40s or 50s. So some people felt old when they were in their 40s. They'd turn grey. Mm. Horace complains about his grey hairs. But other people at 60 say that they feel like old age is approaching in antiquity. So just as we tend not to set a direct limit on when someone changes from being middle-aged to old, the ancients didn't either, I don't think. It depended upon how you felt, it depended upon your circumstances. To say someone was old at 40 would be regarded as extreme, I would have thought. Cicero, for example, at the age of 62, says that he feels old age approaching. Now, he's trying to assert that he's still vigorous, so he doesn't want people to think of him as old and therefore somehow not fully strong. But if someone dies in their 60s in antiquity, they're still regarded as having died quite young, or rather they haven't lived a full 70 years, as the Bible puts it. So I don't think perceptions have changed that much about when someone's old. It's just that more of us today live into old age.
So in the Roman world, was it a class thing? Were the people in the higher levels of society more likely to live to older age? If you were in certain areas of the city, if you moved in certain circles, were you more likely to see old people? Just how much of a visible thing was the greying population?
It's hard to be certain because most of our evidence relates to the upper classes. But it's certain that some parts of the city, some parts of the empire were healthier than others. If you're living up in the hills, you're getting lots of fresh air. The ancient sources say you're probably going to live longer. If you're poor, you're less well nourished. You're living down in less salubrious circumstances, less salubrious environments, then you're probably not going to live necessarily as long. Wealthy people could afford to get out of the city of Rome in summer, so they'd avoid a lot of the diseases, for example. Mm. To be honest, I think class isn't such a big issue, because when you have epidemic diseases or something, they're going to hit people indiscriminately. Access to medical care would make some difference, but again, I think the difference according to class has been exaggerated. I think for most people, life was fairly tough. If you were lucky enough to live on to old age, it wasn't because you were wealthy. It was probably more because you were stronger and healthier, something like that.
Now, what's the oldest Roman that we know of? I mean, their understanding of old could leach into mythological kind of things and long age that you find in those instances. But say the oldest one I could find, and you know, this is just by typing different people into Google, was Livia dying at 86.
Yeah.
So that would have been an old age. Is there any that come to mind who...
She actually attributed her old age to drinking a glass of red wine every day, which I think is timeless advice. It's interesting, actually, because we know a lot more about old Greeks for some reason. It goes with being wise that you should be old and venerable. So a lot of the Greek philosophers are described as having died at very advanced ages. Mm. Clearly, sometimes these ages are exaggerated, or people didn't know how old they were. Like you, I was doing some Googling about this and kept coming up with Greek philosophers. Like in the 5th century BC, you have Empedocles, who according to some ancient sources lived to 109. Another ancient source says he died at the age of 60. Another one says he died at the age of 77. So the main thing is he died in an advanced age.
That's a wide margin of error there, though.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
There's a lovely example of, on tombstones, we get some really Romans living well past 100, according to their tombstone. There's a lovely example from North Africa of a chap called Maximianus, who is supposed to have died at the age of 86, but a poem written on his tombstone says that he lived to be well over 100. You don't get a telegraph from the Queen in antiquity, but the 100 probably means he was very, very old. So exaggeration happens. But anyway, Livia is a good example because we know more about older women in Roman antiquity than about men, simply because Pliny the Elder gives us a list of older women, just in part of his encyclopedia. He doesn't give us such a list for well-known older men, except for one census. The last census that happened in the Principate, in the imperial period, was in AD 73, and Pliny actually lists some of the centenarians recorded there for one part of North Italy. Something like 57 centenarians recorded, including some over the age of 140, according to the census, where you had to tell the truth. So again, I think people are exaggerating their ages, but the oldest Roman that we know of authentically, probably, you're still looking at people living into their 80s and 90s, and there's no reason why someone couldn't live to be 100 in antiquity. It's just that they would have felt very lonely in terms of how many age peers they had.
Mm. And you've also got the problem of, you know, there's no birth certificates back then.
Well, there were. There were birth certificates.
Oh, were there?
But it wasn't compulsory. In Roman Egypt, we have birth certificates surviving, but they tend to be so that you could register someone to get into a particular class group. Also, there's the question of taxation in Egypt. So a male would pay the poll tax in Egypt from the age of 14. Mm. They would be registered at birth, so they'd become eligible at the age of 14. You stopped having to pay tax at the age of 62 in Roman Egypt. So again, you would register death so someone would come off the tax register. But birth registration wasn't done for demographic reasons. It wasn't done to find out how many people there were. It was mainly done for financial or military reasons. The Emperor Tiberius, for example, Suetonius tells us that people weren't exactly sure what year he was born. There were some people who thought he was born in 1 year, others who thought he was born 2 years later. So if an emperor's exact age is uncertain or was uncertain, then for the ordinary person, it's probably even less certain. A lot would go on how you looked, I think. Chronological age is so important to us. We tend to identify people by their age. In Roman Egypt as well, going back to Egypt again, people do identify themselves by their name, the name of their father, any scars they've got on their bodies, and also their age. But you get the same person declaring their ages across a span of years, where their age goes up and down according to how they felt, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Also, if you stop paying tax at the age of 62, you get an awful lot of people who claim to be 63 years old. You get very, very few claim to be 61, funnily enough.
I was wondering if you could give me a bit of a sense of how the Romans perceived old age to be, because they must have been writing about it quite a fair bit in their authorship. So what did they say about it?
Yeah, remember that when you say the Romans, we're really talking about elite Roman males. So we're getting one perspective on it, and maybe we can come back to that, because I think I've written a lot about old age in the Roman world, and as a male, I think one of the failings that I've had in the past is that I've tended to think about it being led by the sources. So if a source tells us something, then as ancient historians, we tend to record it.
Mm.
The gaps are as important. So I'm becoming more and more aware of what's missing from our history of aging in the past is the voices of women to a certain extent, although we're getting more and more awareness of that, but also the lower classes, etc. So when we talk about Roman attitudes towards old age, we get a lot of sources and we get a wide range of approaches, but almost inevitably they tend to come from the upper class adult male. So yeah, with that proviso,
sure,
you do get a range. I mean, people tend to focus on the more positive aspects. So Cicero wrote a dialogue about old age in 44 BC, the De Senectute, which is often said to be a defense of old age or a praise of old age. You know, he's writing, as I said before, at the age of 62. He's writing at a time when the Republic is crumbling. Julius Caesar has just been assassinated. The young Octavian, you know, this 18-year-old, is rising up, and the place of older people, traditionally the Senate, remember, the Senate means the body of older men. Their authority is somehow being challenged or is being weakened. And so he's asserting the importance of older people because he himself is older.
Mm.
Montaigne very famously is supposed to have said that reading the De Senectute, reading Cato's dialogue, gave him the appetite to grow old. Now, if any of your listeners know the source of that quote, because I can't find it anywhere in Montaigne, but I don't think he'd actually read the De Senectute, because it doesn't make one look forward to old age. It more is asserting that old age has its positive qualities and that we shouldn't be so negative about it. So there's one viewpoint about old age that comes through.
Sorry, you just attributed that to Cato as well. Can you give the context of that?
Sorry, yeah. Cicero wrote this work in 44 BC, but he put his ideas into the mouth of Cato the Elder back a century or more before, because he says that the beginning of his dialogue, it will give the work more auctoritas, more authority, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking back to the good old days, where Cato the Elder, who was the epitome of a tough old Roman, fathering a child in his 80s, leading the politics, very strong voice, great orator, etc., into advanced age, Cicero saw him as a model of a strong old age. And he's a good example of an aristocratic, upper-class Roman male who forms very well into an advanced age. So you can find lots of credible quotes, and I'm sure we'll come back to that soon, from the Cicero's work about old age, but often it is more a defense, I would say, than praise of old age in itself. The legal writer Callistratus, writing around about 200 AD, this is recorded in the Digest, in book 50 of the Digest, he says old age has always been revered in our state. And again, you can take these sort of quotes and say, well, here's proof that the Romans praised old age. Callistratus is actually using that statement to then go on to qualify it, to say, but we must realize that younger generations need more authority and that we shouldn't always be stuck in the past, et cetera, et cetera. So taking quotes out of context sometimes can be quite dangerous, I think. If you're looking for any preconceived ideas you have about antiquity, you can always find a primary source that will say it. And so if you are looking for more negative views of old age, then again, there are abundant sources in satire, in art as well, depictions of old age, but also in philosophy. You get, for example, there's a little-known philosopher called Juncus, who is clearly following Cicero. He's probably writing in the 2nd century AD, and brings out, like Cicero, a lot of the more positive qualities that old age can bring. But he also talks about, and well, to sum it up, he says in one sentence that an old man is an oppressive, painful, grievous, and decrepit spectacle. In short, an Iliad of woes, which is quite a stunning phrase. You know, an epic poem of
very poetic,
of woes.
Yeah.
This is Juncus preserved in Stobaeus's Florilegium, book 50. Aristotle, for example, going back to the Greeks, talks a lot about positive and negative depictions, again, that polarity. Aristotle argues for the mean, and so the young are immature, the old are past their prime, whereas the best is in the middle years, in the 40s or 50s, those decades. And I think that reflects also Roman reality to a certain extent. If you think about the minimum age to be consul at Rome in the Republic was 42, and that was sort of the age where you were thought to be at your prime, I guess.
Mm.
To sum it up, really, Seneca the Younger puts it extremely well. This is Seneca the Younger in his consolation to Marcia. He says that all people experience old age differently. And I think that's a very wise thing to say. In some of the older treatments about old age in the past, it's people have stereotyped. So it's said that the Greeks revered old age while the Romans detested it. It's naive, I think, to expect that a whole civilization has one view. It depends massively upon an individual's perception of another individual and how that person in their later years performs, how useful they are in society, that sort of thing. Mm. Will affect massively how people view old age.
Yeah. So what was an old person's role in Rome then? I mean, I know this is going to be different at different levels of society, but once you hit a particular age, what sort of function did you bring to the Roman society?
A lot would depend upon, well, all sorts of factors like gender, for example. So if we start with women, it depends a lot whether or not she has produced children. So an older woman who has produced children, who has grandchildren, she'll be expected, I think, to have certainly a maternal role, a sort of a guardian role within the household as a mater familias, also looking after grandchildren. They would have that sort of role in society. An older woman who hasn't produced children or who has no children surviving, which for many people would be a reality because of the high infant mortality rates, they would be in a singularly unenviable position, I think. And we tend not to hear about them. It's almost like they disappear off the radar. We don't tend to hear about many older women, apart from the Livias of the world, women who are connected to powerful husbands, powerful children, or whatever. We hear about older people as beggars. I think that would have been a reality for a lot of people, because there's no welfare state to look after you. If you don't have family, if you don't have your own wealth, if you can't afford to have slaves to look after you, and if you become incapacitated in old age, then you would simply, I think, disappear off the radar.
Mm.
For a man, it would depend enormously upon, again, what they'd done in their life. There's a lot of talk in inscriptions about someone dying, having saved up from earlier years for a secure old age. A nice example of someone dying at 50 saying that for all his life he's been worrying about how he's going to survive into old age, and he's glad he's died at 50 so he can stop worrying about it now. It's no longer a problem. It's the one example, for Latin scholars among your listeners, it's the one example I've ever come across on this tombstone where he addresses his rock, O Saxe, he says. So it's evocative of Saxum rock, which isn't a common thing in Latin.
Where was that?
It's in North Africa. Different regions of the empire, you tend to get inscriptions for different sorts of age groups being predominant. So in North Africa, older people are extremely common on inscriptions. Or rather, ages are stated more commonly for older people in North Africa. So lots of good evidence.
Yeah. I get the impression that there was more opportunity for older men to take a more active role in society, whether it be in business or in the Senate. But those sort of things, there's more opportunity. Would that be correct?
Again, it depends upon the individual. Yeah. A lot depends upon what you've done in your lifetime. There's a, I was going to say a wonderful, in fact, it's rather boring, very long work by Plutarch saying that old men should rule. So he takes it a step further than Cicero, where Cicero is saying old men still have an important role in the state. Plutarch saying they not only have an important role, they have an absolutely vital role, and the young people should wait their turn. Mm. It's vital that old people rule the state. Now, the fact that he's pushing that so strongly suggests, I think, if you read between the lines, that there's a problem there and that older people are being sidelined to a certain extent. I think the same thing was happening in the family. So you have the paterfamilias in Roman society, you know, the oldest man, the father or the grandfather, paternal grandfather, who holds all authority over his children, that they can own nothing, even if they're adult males, they can own nothing because the paterfamilias owns everything. That's the legal theory, and Cicero, for example, pushes it very strongly, says that the paterfamilias should be revered as a god, he says at one point in one of his works. I suspect this is because his son Marcus didn't revere him like a god, to be absolutely honest. You see this in classical Athens, and I think it's happening in Rome as well, that when you reach a certain age, especially if some of the problems that commonly associated with old age are catching up with you physically and mentally, then you should step aside and let the younger generation, in reality, take over to a certain extent. You certainly see this again in Roman Egypt, where you get contracts drawn up between children and their parents. They say, we'll look after you in your old age as long as you transfer the property, the control of the farm over to us. So you make a written arrangement there. I think in reality that's happening, even among the upper classes, where it may be that they're less concerned about the financial side of old age because they've got wealth, they've got plenty of land, they've got slaves, etc. But they still need someone to look after them, and they still want someone also to bury them and remember them positively after death. And so there's a concern there to, unofficially, I think, to pass control over to the next generation while you still can. Mm. I think that's happening. And certainly Romans, in drawing up their wills, you can draw up a gift in anticipation of death, for example. So you'll say, I will pass this on to my children, and in return they should show me pietas, they should show me gratitude, and they should look after me. So that sense of an arrangement, a negotiation going on between generations. Mm. So yes, there would be an expectation, as Cicero says, that older people should be revered and seen as stores of wisdom, etc. But the fact that you've got to assert that so strongly suggests that in reality it's not automatic, it's not always happening.
So was there also household religious obligations for older people to carry out?
The paterfamilias certainly was the head of the family religion, so that role would continue. But it's not something associated strictly with old age. If you think about especially women becoming mothers at a relatively young age by our standards. So most women by the age of 20, certainly Augustus's marriage laws, expects them to have children. You're going to be a grandmother in that case, possibly in your 40s. It's not that we should equate being a grandparent with old age. It's a more senior role, certainly. So it's not that old age itself brought particular new responsibilities or something. It's just that the longer you live, the longer you're capable, the more you would be expected to take on these roles. On the other hand, there are certain priesthoods or even oracles, for example, being associated with older people, especially. Mm. So we think of the Sibyl of Cumae, for example, as an older woman. I think this isn't necessarily showing honour to old age. It's more that the elderly are seen to be nearer death, to put it bluntly, and they're sort of on the threshold between the natural world and the supernatural. And so they have a certain numinosity about them, as one author has put it. They're closer to the gods in a way. So,
in a way?
Whether you see that as positive or not, they do have a particular role in terms of religion, in terms of magic as well. Mm. The stereotypes that Romans have of older women are absolutely vicious in some cases. You see this in poems by Horace and Ovid and Martial, where old witches, for example, it's a common stereotype that we still have. That comes very much from Roman tradition. Mm. Amazing, when you start looking for teeth problems in old age, there's amazingly a lot about older women losing their teeth and about the Graiae. These fabled female older monsters have one tooth between three of them, which they pass around when it's mealtime. It's evil, nasty, nasty stuff, it must be said.
So we've got some ancient medical sources. We've got quite a lot of ancient medical writings, say, from Galen. So what was the ancient knowledge of the medical process of aging?
There's a lot of discussion in the medical sources about aging, because in the Hippocratic school that Galen inherited, when a patient comes to you, you look at not only his or her gender, but also their age. Age is seen as a very important factor in terms of diagnosing problems. Mm. And so a lot of discussion in the medical sources. We have so much medical evidence, and a lot of it is based around different age groups, common ailments, common problems associated with particular age groups. This goes back to the theory of the four humours, that you have a balance of the humours. The four humours, as we know, are blood and yellow bile, phlegm and black bile. Black bile, the Greek word, is melancholy. So as you age, blood and yellow bile become lacking. You start losing those humours, and the humours of phlegm and black bile, melancholy, take over, which is why old age is melancholic, but it's also very dry. So as you age, the body dries out and gets colder. And so old age is both dry and cold, and that's why the humours have become unbalanced, and you do shrivel up in old age, stereotypically, and become much colder. So the symptoms become worse.
Right, so it was an attempt to explain the process that
absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, wow, absolutely. Yeah. And that was a pervasive theory well into the 17th, 18th century in terms of treatment. So, you know, you get things like bloodletting, you get things like cupping, etc. Some of these things would have been helpful, trying to warm the aged body, for example, but also some of the problems were simply exacerbated by these sorts of treatments.
Yeah.
So, yes, so you start off as an infant being warm and moist. I think it's a powerful image. And as you approach old age and become older, you become cold and dry until effectively like a corpse, you have dried out totally and die. Nice. And what's interesting about the medical sources is, although the emphasis in so much of the material in antiquity is about physical decline in old age, you do sometimes get mention of mental decline as well. Galen, in one of his works, this is in volume 4 of Kuhn, talks about the deterioration not just in physical but also in physiological terms. He says, so why do many people become demented when they reach extreme old age, a period which has been shown to be dry? This is not a result of dryness, he says, but of coldness, for this clearly damages all the activities of the soul. So certain amount of awareness in antiquity or in the medical sources, that it's not just physical decline, it's also can be mental.
There must have been some sort of acknowledgement that it's a natural process, but was there the perception that it's a disease at all? Seneca calls it a horrible disease, but I don't know if he's being poetic by calling it that.
Yeah. Galen actually argues against this quite strongly. So it's a common perception that old age was a disease. In fact, Terence, in one of his plays, calls old age a disease. Seneca the Younger says, not only is it a disease, it's an incurable disease. He talks about this in his long and quite brilliant work on the brevity of life, De Brevitate Vitae. He talks a lot about reflecting on what old age brings. But Galen argues against the fact that it's a disease. He says that it's a natural part of the living process. It's not necessarily a negative thing. It's simply natural and not that we shouldn't try and fight against it, but that we must accept it. I think that's one of the dominant messages that comes through from antiquity, and it's something that is worth hearing again in the 21st century, that we must accept old age, look for its positive qualities, because it does have positive qualities, but also accept the fact that there is decline and that we can't be as young as we might wish to be all the time.
So I was wondering, in Cicero's great work on old age, if there's a few bits of advice that we could get from Cicero for those of us who are on the wrong side of 30 like me.
Yeah, 30's a long time ago now. Cicero focuses on four, what he calls forward tuperationes. I think it's a wonderful word. Four things that people criticize about old age. And he says, first of all, that old age takes you away from doing what you did when you were younger. Mm. You can no longer do, you know, the things you used to enjoy. And Cicero has Cato say that that's a real blessing, because you're no longer fixated by these things. You can get on with more intellectual things like philosophy. Second vituperatio is that old age weakens the body. You're physically less strong. And again, Cicero says this is a good thing, because you can devote yourself more to your mind, to the things of the mind, philosophy, for example. This is Cicero the philosopher. Thirdly, that old age lacks pleasures, and he's thinking of sexual pleasure in particular. And again, he says this is a good thing, because you're not so distracted by your physical desires and you can get on with more important things like philosophy, for example. And then fourthly, that old age is not far from death. And again, Cicero says that this is a good thing, because death, as Plato Socrates had already observed, is not something to be feared. It's either like permanent sleep, which is a positive thing, is something to enjoy, or you're being reunited with all your friends. So there's nothing to fear in death. Now, these have been often quoted, and they're beautifully expressed. I'm reading the De Senectute with one of my classes at the moment here in Melbourne. You've got to say that for most people in the ancient world, these weren't the main concerns about old age. So it's very much an aristocratic male point of view. For most older people in the ancient world, it was more, who's going to look after me? Where is the next meal going to come from? Things like that. The concerns are different. So, you know, the Montaignes of the world, the aristocratic gentlemen of the world, reading the De Senectute may find this positive praise of old age. But I think it is just one perspective looking at old age, and it is Cicero, the wealthy philosopher.
I was wondering if I could get a sense of what you think is missing from our knowledge of old age in the Roman Empire. I mean, I know we lack good knowledge about the lower levels of society. I know that we lack knowledge about women. But what do you think is missing, and what do you think could be added to this kind of knowledge?
Yeah, as I said before, one of the things I realize as I'm getting older myself is that I have been very much guided by what our sources tell us, and that if a source doesn't tell us something, then we tend not to focus in on it quite so much. Gender is a good example. There's a quote from Cicero. When I'm talking about Roman old age, I like to quote this quote because I think it is such a powerful statement. Cicero has Cato say that old age will only be respected if it fights for itself, maintains its rights, avoids dependence on anyone, and asserts control over its own to the very last breath. Now, it's a wonderful statement, but for a lot of older people in antiquity, that simply wasn't possible, especially, I suspect, for older women. To be able to maintain their own rights, their rights have been eroded, they're very few, they can't avoid dependence on anyone because of physical decline or whatever. So what happens to those people? Cicero, in one of his other works, it's in the Tusculan Disputations, and I came across it quite by chance quite recently, where he's talking about an athlete who complains about the fact that he's not getting the best diet, he's not getting choice steaks every day, etc. Cicero says that athletes should remember that, for example, old women often go without food for 2 or 3 days. And he just slips that through as, you know, almost a proverbial saying. Mm. It's a glimpse into a very harsh reality that for a certain types of society that we simply don't normally hear about, where the next meal is coming from is absolutely uncertain. So, well, Cicero says people complain about old age because it takes away power. But for most people in the ancient world, there were much greater concerns than that. In their old age, concerns about who was going to look after them, where the next meal was going to come from. Mm. So certainly I think the biggest gap we have for the 99.9% of the population who weren't senators or in a senatorial family or a Christian family, the realities of life for those people. And we're beginning to start asking those questions. And once you start looking, the medical evidence, the legal evidence, for example, provides much more information than I think we've realised in the past.
That's Professor Tim Parkin, who holds the Elizabeth and James Tertullus Chair of Classics at the University of Melbourne. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review there. They are, as always, appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Tim on Twitter. Tim is at Timbo Artemis, nice handle, which is at T-I-M-B-O-A-R-T-E-M-I-S. And I am at Nightlight Guy. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.